Oh, good morning. And welcome to March, which is Celebrate Women's Month. And today, as I understand, also happens to be the commemoration day of Maha Prajapati, who is the first Buddhist nun. The first, if you will, female home leaver at a time when, well, leaving home was, for a woman, was not the thing to do. And so I want to talk about Maha Prajapati. As a nun, I think growing up in Ireland, you know, where higher education was not a priority for the women in the family, the nuns, and we were surrounded by nuns in Ireland, to me held out a very important example of just another way to be, apart from, you know, being a mother and having babies and raising and taking care of a family. There were no examples of women living alone or even much of women going out to work at the time. The government explicitly taxed women, 50% married women, to discourage them from taking jobs from men. So to see examples of women who were professionals, educators, nurses, was a huge model for me. And I contemplated, maybe for all of 5 seconds, becoming a nun. It wasn't the vow of poverty so much, it was really the vow of obedience where I balked. And so what I learned when I went to this international conference of women in Buddhism in Vaishali, India, this year, was still the importance, the very importance of this role of becoming a nun for women in developing countries, countries where young girls don't routinely get an education, where their role is to stay home, serve the men, have babies. And there were a lot of these nuns at the conference, many from all over the world, but especially the ones in Southeast Asia, who are still struggling with the huge disparity in these countries where women still don't have equal rights, but the disparities between the access to resources that nuns and monks have, access to education, to the financial support of the community, still enormous struggles for parity. And so my eyes were opened to, in a way, it was like going there was like leaving the palace walls as a Buddhist and discovering and learning about, one, the many types of Buddhism, and two, the vast differences in opportunities that women have to lead and to teach in their communities as Buddhists. And so I learned that I have many, many, we have many, many privileges here that are unheard of in parts of the world. And so I just wanted to maybe spend some time in retracing maybe the steps of where we come from. And I think that this is where the figure of Mahaprajapati looms so importantly. She was, of course, the Buddha's stepmother. Shakyamuni's own mother died several days after giving birth. And Pajati was, she was known as Gautama at the time. Pajati means mother of great child. So Pajati was the younger sister, and she nursed and raised the Buddha as a child. She was later given the name Maha Pajati, which means great mother of a great child. So when Shakyamuni grew up and left to become a wandering ascetic, to return maybe 6 years later, already a magnetic and charismatic teacher with day by day more and more followers, he came back to the clan and was teaching, so that even the menfolk in the clan, including like Ananda, his cousin, wanted to leave with him and go traveling around and be home leavers. And it so happened at the time there'd been a battle around water rights or something between neighboring clans, which led a lot of the young men to die. So that you had a lot of widows left when Shakyamuni took off with the menfolk. And they gathered around Mahaprajapati, and they'd heard the teachings. They were familiar firsthand with impermanence, dukkha, and perhaps started to practice. And they said, we want to follow in the path of Shakyamuni. We want to do what the men are doing, which is to take up our begging bowl and become mendicants. So Mahaprajapati goes to the woods to find the Buddha and respectfully puts this request. We, the women folk, would like to also be home leavers. The Buddha was silent. She asked three times, and his response was still silence. So she went back to the palace, dejected, and thought about it. What could the problem be here? All right, so maybe he's afraid. He feels protective. He doesn't want us to come to any harm. He thinks that as women, you know, we would fall victims of bandits and all kinds of bad stuff out there. You know, which when I was in Vaishali at the conference, the roads were patrolled by armed guards because we would come back and forward, nuns, scholars, lay folk, between the temple where the conference was being held and the hotel. Guys carrying rifles. So this is in our day, and I'm sure probably wasn't much safer at the time of the Buddha. So still, she thought, this was not good enough. Not a good enough reason. So she cropped her hair, took off her lady's elegant garments, donned the orange rags, and gathered her women folk, apparently there were about 500 of them, and set out on foot to catch up with the Buddha, who was at Vaishali, 150 miles away. So talk about leaving home. That's leaving home with a vengeance. When they arrive, Ananda comes out to find what is the commotion. And you can imagine his surprise when he sees his aristocratic aunt with their short, disheveled hair and dirty clothes, her bloodied, swollen feet, with this mob of other women. And he's saying, so what's going on? And she says, we need your help, Ananda. We are determined in our resolution to follow in the path of the Buddha. And we want to be able to be given permission to join the community, to be part of the Sangha. Please help us. So Ananda goes back in, tells the Buddha, Shakyamuni again falls into silence. And Ananda says, so what is this? You know, you've been preaching that men and women, each have the possibility of awakening. Are you now saying that this is good in theory, but you're not going to stand behind these women actually wanting to embark, to be home leavers? Do you believe they're competent or you don't? And the Buddha says, well, he says they are. And Ananda says, you know, and the other point about it is, here's this woman who actually raised you and nursed you. So I think you owe her. So the Buddha ponders. And so, you know, we need to put ourselves in his position. Here was this society that was not used to ever seeing a woman in any other role other than wife, mother, daughter. And the idea of her now setting forth, becoming self-determining, being in her own right, was probably profoundly disturbing to the social order. Now, Shakyamuni already had a reputation for disturbing the social order. Here he'd come to tell people who at this time were still mired in rigid caste system, beholden to the Brahmanic priests who would offer protection through their very exact rituals and incantations, spells, and that the whole society had been in thrall, you see, to this following these magical rituals. And the Buddha's saying, don't believe anything on hearsay. Put your own experience to the test. So whatever I tell you, don't believe it. Put it to the test of your own experience. So this is a time, you know, where there are these immense sea changes in moving from a kind of an iron-bound social system that's very rigid to this teacher who's now having immense influence, encouraging young men to drop out, to find their own liberation, to cut their ties with their families, and to tread the path of self-realization in a way which is a kind of very highly individualistic way of, in a society that is very bound to ties, relationships. So here he has this on the one hand, there are already grumbles and rumors and, you know, there's some political fallout about this. So on top of this, now we have the women who are asking for permission to join this this movement. The other, of course, issue and stumbling block, I think, was that the whole bedrock on which this home leaving was based was that of celibacy, wasn't it? That you cut your attachments, took up the bowl, the alms bowl, but essentially it was breaking your ties to, well, I guess what we would roughly call the physical comfort, sensuality, everything that kind of women embody in those days. And so maybe, you know, Shakyamuni thought, well, if I'm endorsing or enjoining these men to leave behind their ties to women, does it really make sense for these men to be surrounded with temptation by their proximity to women all the time? And so he could see that maybe that might be problematic. Not to mention that these monks themselves may not have been too happy about the idea of having women join them. It's one thing for a society to support the monk by looking up to him as an emblem of someone who has vanquished his ties to the carnal, if you will. But what if women are around? Then what are people going to think? Are they really sincere in what they're? Are they really able to walk their talk? So I do think that the whole celibacy, the idea of the home leaver, you see, as we have seen it from the time of the Buddha and in all spiritual institutions, we can see the road bumps, not the very least in terms currently of what our the Vatican is having to deal with, the conclusions of where this journey has led. I want to also say as an aside that at this conference, where the story of Maha Prajapati was brought up, but it was interesting to me in that these nuns and scholars were perfectly happy with the one theory that said the Buddha was really very concerned about their safety of this woman, and that was it, end of story. The idea that this enlightened being who, you know, had very clearly seen into the nature of reality, the emptiness of all things, who saw the nature of his own relationship to all phenomena, past, present, future, that he had this very profound insight into just that emptiness, the fact that things are constantly changing, there's no fixed reality. And yet, you see, the difficulty is when you have to function in a world that is dealing with an historic reality, with social forces, you can't, it seems to me, wave a magic wand. And yet, it was deemed heretical when I put it to the gathering that Shakyamuni may very understandably have been a product also of his time and had to deal with the social forces that were handed him. Heretical as that may be, I still stand by it. Without the support of these wonderful scholars and nuns who I think are still at this point in time laboring under some of the strictures that were put in place at that day. So to end the story, though, of how Shakyamuni, how he came down when Ananda was pressuring him, he settled on a compromise solution. And he said, okay, women may join the Sangha, but they have 8 more rules than the men. And these are the rules. These are the conditions. The first one is that a nun, no matter how old she might be, how senior, she must always bow down to a monk, however young he is. Individual ordinations of nuns have to be approved by a group of monks only. Nuns wouldn't be able to spend an ango period anywhere unless a monk was in residence. Any woman who broke a rule, her punishment would be greater than that of men. And the monks could criticize and correct the nuns, but the nuns didn't have permission to correct the monks. Now, later record keepers claim that Shakyamuni in private said to Ananda that the Dharma would only last 500 years instead of 1,000 on account of allowing women into the Sangha. Now, you know, we do have to take all of this, and, you know, these scholars are scrupulously poring over texts and canons and this word and that word and how they relate or not. I mean, the truth is that things were not put into writing until 500 years after Shakyamuni's life. And so this is really what I think the people at the conference was saying, was that this gave plenty of time for all kinds of institutional distortions to be inserted into the records. And that's what has come down to our day. As I say, my eyes were opened to the struggles that other Buddhist women around the world still have. That for in some places it is still a revolutionary act to become a nun. And in many places they cannot become a fully ordained nun because of all of these catch-22 regulations regarding monks, and where it still leaves them at a disadvantage and unable to have access to the financial and educational resources of the community. Joan Halifax, actually this weekend, had an article published in the Washington Post where she's talking about how women are remaking Buddhism. She points out, of course, that there are more roshis, women roshis, in this country than there ever were in Asian countries. And she talks about also the opportunities women teachers, Western women teachers, have when they visit countries in Asia to push the river of gender parity in the right direction just by modeling their own leadership, their own status. And she shared a story of how she accompanied this nun who was the first bhikkhuni, which is a nun. She was the first ordained nun in Thailand in the last few years, because it was against the law in Thailand for a nun to ordain. And they did a round of alms collecting. And Roshi Jones says, though the nun was subjected to death threats as a result of choosing to be ordained as a nun, she invited me to join her in her daily alms round. With bare feet, her in her russet robes and me in my black Zen robes, we made our way through the neighborhood adjacent to the nunnery. As we slowly walked in the heat of an early Thai morning, some households closed their doors tightly as we neared them. Others opened their doors, and men and women brought food to us. Though my eyes were cast down, I became aware that some of the women wept as they stood before us. I saw men with their hands shaking as they put rice into our begging bowls. And she so continues, at that time I had no idea how radical an act this was. I only knew that my head was bare to the sun, my feet were bare to the road, and my heart was bare as I received food from these lay women and men. Later, I realized that we had not only broken the law, but we'd broken open the door that separates women practitioners from being who they really are in that country. So, This is a very radical act in some parts of the world, something that we take completely for granted. And where we are at, it seems to me, is that we are, for our time and our place, given the possibilities and the opportunities now as women we have, there are so many choices. And we can have positions of leadership and contribute to our society, is that we have the luxury to reinvent what it means to leave home. And this is to say that in the same way that Prajapati had to completely fly in the face of what Shakyamuni was letting her believe, something in her said, I don't believe this story. I don't believe what I'm being told, that I can't go forth, protect myself and my sisters, and follow the way. For our time, this leaving home, we realize, is not a question of this physical act. Many of us have done that. Many of us are even living alone, which is first time history of humanity, that a woman can be economically self-sufficient, can support herself, may have to, although even that's, I think, changing, have to remove the sort of shackles that says, what's wrong with me? I'm alone. I don't have a man. Even that, you see. And that we are having to uncover again, what are these internal beliefs? What are these internal stories, however subtle, that are still keeping us bound? You see, like the aristocratic ladies in their castle, in their palace. What are these beliefs that I've inherited, the legacy of all of our journeying? The stories we've been told by our fathers about who we can and cannot be. And that for us, this is the home leaving. And we face it in each moment when we react, each moment when we hold back in fear or say, I can't do this. That we have the great good fortune, based on the struggles of these women who have gone before us, who have opened doors and who have trod that path, that our job is to keep it going and to keep forging ahead and discovering what those internal, which is not to say there are not plenty of external barriers that keep us bound. To a sense of our own limits. So, thank you, Maha Prajapati, great mother of all the great children who she has nursed and raised to live to our fullest potential.